The Big Picture, a Christian insight into the world of movies, television and pop culture with magazine editor Ben McKechin and scriptwriter Mark Hadley. A Bible Society Australia production, sharing the light of God's Word into every corner of your world.
La 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 la. I'm Ben McKechin.
And I'm his understudy, Mark Hadley. Welcome to episode 57 of The Big Picture for the week beginning May the 1st. And coming up on today's show, Meryl Streep can't sing. And she's not doing it again in another movie.
God's Not Dead 2, the sequel. So I take it God's still alive. We'll be talking about that very soon.
Plus, we're giving you a night at the opera and a side serving of my top five musicals ever, of all time.
You are most welcome. Great to be here again at The Big Picture. Before we get stuck into all that kind of stuff like Meryl Streep can't sing and God's Not Dead 2, this week, also around the traps, Mark, is a little film you might like to call Captain America Civil War.
I'd like to call it that. I am thrilled.
It is actually the title. It was out last Thursday, biggest film around, or basically it should have been called Captain America versus Iron Man. But I take it because Batman versus Superman's already got the versus thing. They didn't want to go for that. We're going to be reviewing that movie on the show next week. So what I'd be recommending to you is don't see it this week. Wait till you hear our review next week and then make up your mind after that.
Or do what I do and watch it six times and then still listen anyway.
Do that.
Okay, well, look, like a bit of bespoke programming, if you're not into
bespoke.
Bespoke programming.
We're using words like bespoke now?
We are when we're talking about Grand Designs Season 13.
The bespoke edition.
Well, Kevin MacLeod is back, and basically he spends his great... Well, actually, to be honest, he's back 20 minutes ago. Yes, if you're looking to watch this program, it started 20 minutes ago. 7:40 on Sunday nights on the ABC, but don't touch that dial if you still have a dial on a radio somewhere, because there's always iView. That's what you have for these
very
things.
True. Grand Designs is a great show.
It is.
A movie, I'm not sure whether it's good, bad, or indifferent, is also out now. It's called Mother's Day. I wasn't flocking to see this. It stars Julia Roberts. I like Julia Roberts. She goes all right. Jennifer Aniston, Jason Sudeikis, and Kate Hudson in a movie that looks like one of those Hollywood movies that's either on a particular topic, like Love Actually, or on a special day, like Valentine's Day or New Year's Eve. That's what Mother's Day seems to be capturing on screen in a Hollywood fashion.
It's made by the same guy who did Valentine's Day.
Oh, is it? Well, yeah, that's so not if inspiring you like,
I know,
me.
I was about
it's not inspiring
to say.
Me, but it may inspire others.
It might inspire
it's
others.
It's the cinemas now.
Okay, well, look, we're giving you advance notice to this next one. So start planning your parties now, because the 2016 Eurovision Song Contest...
Oh!
Yes.
I love Eurovision contests.
I know, and people need a little bit of warning. So we're not going to say it like, oh, it's tomorrow. It's on May 10, and guess it goes basically for 4 days. Who is Australia's representative? Christian singer Dami Im, who also happens to have won that little singing ditty called The X Factor.
Oh, it's, that old thing.
Yeah, so it's airing on SBS. Don't miss it.
But can she smash Eurovision? I'm going to get my Viking horns out of the cupboard in anticipation of Eurovision. Love Eurovision. In entertainment news this week, and in a bold attempt to get more young people into cinemas, one of America's largest cinema chains is considering allowing its customers to use mobile phones during films. Now, already some reviewers, and I agree with these reviewers, they're likening it to the end of civilization itself, which I think, fair enough. You go to the movies to not look at your phone. Isn't that you're going there to just watch the movie? You're not going there to multitask.
Why don't they just allow people to poke other people randomly while they're, you know?
But apparently the head of this cinema chain called AMC Entertainment, a guy, his name's Adam Aaron, has said you can't tell a 22-year-old to turn off their cell phone, their mobile phone. That's just how they live their life now.
Yes, you can.
Yes, you can. I thought, yes, you can.
Yeah,
we're in the movie.
That.
Turn your phone off.
Have you got your phone on right now? Turn it off.
I really hope that's not the future.
Gosh, look, Paramount Pictures and DreamWorks Pictures have announced that a production is underway on, wait for it, Ghost in the Shell. Now, you might not think this is a big thing, but I'm telling you, it is huge, okay? Probably not a big issue for many people in Australia, but Ghost in the Shell is one of those huge manga properties overseas, okay? In fact,
Japanese
anime
movie.
Manga, massive.
Comic turned movie.
Yeah, it's huge. Scarlett Johansson, yes, the Black Widow, is actually playing the lead role. It's directed by Rupert Sanders, who did Snow White and the Huntsman. Well, that's not a real recommendation, but still, it's actually a really great film. The film is shooting in Wellington, New Zealand. Paramount Pictures will release the film in Australia on March 30, 2017. I am officially counting down.
All right, now we're up to true or false time of the show. I don't know why I'm leading into this, because you actually have the fact and you're going to challenge us as to whether this is a lie or not.
Are you ready to play?
I am.
Remember that little film by Bill Shakespeare called Romeo and Juliet?
That film by Bill Shakespeare?
Yeah,
he made movies?
One. He did.
Oh, he did, okay.
He would have if he could.
Okay, okay. Please continue. Yes, I remember this thing of which you talk.
That 1996 film by Baz Luhrmann, channeling Bill Shakespeare, launched more than a few careers, and it also forged a strong relationship between the director, Baz Luhrmann, and lead heartthrob, Leonardo DiCaprio. Okay, now, Leonardo DiCaprio was desperate to work in another Baz Luhrmann film. Okay, that is not under question here. Before he landed
That's true.
Before he landed Gatsby in The Great Gatsby, he also asked for an audition for which one? A, Paul Mercurio's character in a suggested American remake of Strictly Ballroom. B, Ewan McGregor's character in Moulin Rouge. Or C, Hugh Jackman's character in Australia.
Oh, mate, I really want to say C. I don't care if that's true or not. Leonardo, that is fantastic.
One of those is true. He was desperate. He actually desired this role more than anything else. Which one is it?
Well, I really hope it is that one. You will bring us the answer after we do our first Now Showing segment for the show.
I will indeed. And our first Now Showing segment for this week is God's Not Dead 2, just in case you weren't sure. 2 years ago, a small-budget Christian movie made a fistful of dollars at the American box office. It was God's Not Dead, but it didn't just stir up cinema attendance. It soon became the example of why people love or hate Christian movies. Fans loved its desire to stand up for Christian faith. Haters loathed its extreme and cheesy depiction of anyone who opposed God. Released in Australia this week was God's Not Dead 2. Despite its being better than the original, Ben believes the sequel continues to suffer from the same way it tries to fight the good fight for the good news.
In this day and age, people seem to forget that the most basic human right of all is the right to believe.
Please go free! Please go free!
No prayers, no moments of silence, nothing.
Think of the other children out there who are subjected to their repressive belief system.
If we sit by and do nothing, the pressure that we're feeling today will mean persecution tomorrow. We're at war.
What makes nonviolence so radical is its unwavering commitment to a nonviolent approach.
Isn't that sort of like what Jesus meant when he said that we should love our enemies?
Yes.
Mark, God's Not Dead, as you just said, did cop a lot of flack, even though it copped a lot of money as well when it came out in the States. God's Not Dead 2, you are exactly right. I did feel it was better than the original. Better acted, better scripted. The cast, they're not huge names that are in this film, but the acting talent is better. You've got Sabrina the Teenage Witch, Melissa Joan Hart. She's playing the lead character of Grace Wesley. Even the name of her character is like loaded up with all this Christian meaning. Grace Wesley.
Yeah.
Jeepers. She's a school teacher in the States. And separate to the scenario of the first movie, which had a college professor, an atheist college professor, kind of fighting against a Christian student in his classroom and a few other characters around. This movie has Grace Wesley, the teacher, being Christian, and she's going up against the system because in her classroom, as that clip just described, in her history classroom, she dares to mention the name of Jesus and some of the things he said and talk about him in the same way as talking about Gandhi or about Martin Luther King. And in rapid sequences that go for like seemingly like 5 minutes, all of a sudden she seems to be in the high court and she's facing this big case that seems to be about the separation of church and state, but is it really? And the makers of the film would suggest no, it's not. No, this is about the persecution of Christians in the West for expressing their viewpoints and basically how they feel. And God's Not Dead suggested the same thing, how a lot of Christians feel that they can't share what they believe anymore in the West. So this is a sort of sequel, but more in spirit, even though there are some characters from the first movie that overlap into the second one.
So it's more
the
argument that's being carried on. Were you kind of surprised the way you liked it? Because I know,
yeah, I was.
I know you. There was a lot of flack on God's Not Dead.
Yeah, I didn't actually see God's Not Dead until I saw God's Not Dead 2. So I saw that, then I went back and watched the original. And it's just much better in most departments. Unfortunately, it does still suffer from its same, the way it desires to get across its message. And one of the downsides of the film is it's preaching to the choir. So it's really a film that's directed squarely at Christians, people who already believe the good news of Jesus. There's nothing wrong with making a movie like that, but it's just the way in which they go about it. And it can be not as shrill or hysterical as the first movie, but it can still be very black and white to the point of alienating you as a viewer watching this film at the way the persecution of Christians is being presented.
Yeah, well, one of the things that people, I mean, Christian and non-Christian reviewers have picked up on this, one of the things they're kind of concerned about is the way that people who don't believe is being are being presented. Do you think that's heavy-handed? Do you think it's ham-fisted?
Yeah, it is. It is. Again, not as much as the first one, but the first one was like, my goodness, like off the charts in terms of painting anybody who was against God or at least didn't believe in Christianity, effectively just painting them as terrible, terrible people. And in God's Not Dead 2, a similar thing happens. The best example of it is the lawyer who's going up against Melissa Joan Hart's teacher, played by an excellent actor from the Twin Peaks series years ago called Ray Wise. But he's dressed in black constantly and he spits venom such as, I don't just hate Grace Wesley. I hate everything she stands for, everything she believes in. I want to destroy her because she is destroying the fabric of our society. That to me strikes me as overstatement. Overstatement. And God's Not Dead 2, like the first one, likes to overstate its case. And even as a person who believes in Christianity and upholds a lot of the values that they're trying to uphold in this film, it's pushing me away as a viewer. Because it's just drawing the way life is in a way that is so one-dimensional and so extreme that you just think you're making a bigger deal out of something when there is a still a big deal to be made, but you're making too much out of it.
Yeah, well, that's the idea, though. That shouldn't Christians be making a big deal? I mean, I guess the opposite end of the scale is you don't want us to be silent, but shouldn't we be making a fuss about stuff that matters to us?
Yeah, mate, I think the short story is yes, Christians should be. It should be encouraging Christians to make movies for Christian viewers or for wider audiences. The issue with God's Not Dead and God's Not Dead 2 is as well as some parts of it can be made, even as strong as some of the speeches are, it just has this divisive effect where it's suggesting that Christians think the way the world operates or is completely against them. Now, there's plenty of parts of the Bible that talk about the things of the world being against God's, the way of God goes and his people. That's true. But when it's painted on screen in such extreme colors, I don't know how those behind God's Not Dead and the sequel think that they're doing anything beyond giving someone a shot in the arm who already thinks they're being persecuted. And even talk about persecution in the US without really mentioning persecution going on around the rest of the world where Christians are treated much more extreme ways, just adds up to this movie where as much as you want Christian filmmakers to be talking about things that are important to them, and there is persecution, there is opposition to Christians going on, but when you just put it on screen with such a effectively hysterical message, it ends up falling crushing, clanging back down to earth. I'd really like to talk up God's Not Dead 2 more, but I really can't. I don't think I can recommend it.
Okay, well, look, God's Not Dead 2 is on limited release. So actually, if you do want to follow it up, form your own opinion, head to godsnotdeadthemovie.com.au for information about where it's screening. It's rated PG for mild themes and stars a better-than-average cast for a Christian movie. Melissa Joan Hart, Jesse Metcalf, Ray Wise, and the Newsboys, who are about to show up on the big picture real soon.
Yeah, and still to come, a month of Sundays at cinemas, as well as Meryl Streep cannot sing. And we're going to tell you why.
Okay. Well, a little earlier, we posed a not so much true or false as a multiple choice. Leonardo DiCaprio was desperate to be in a Baz Luhrmann film after his Romeo plus Juliet film experience. Was it A, Paul Mercurio's character in a suggested American remake of Strictly Ballroom? Was it B, Ewan McGregor's character in Moulin Rouge? Or was it C, Hugh Jackman's character in Australia that he was coveting? Ben?
I really hope it's C.
You really hope it's C? It's actually B. I know that was, it's really interesting because Baz Luhrmann and DiCaprio actually forged this really strong relationship on the set of 1996 Romeo and Juliet, and Leonardo wanted in on Moulin Rouge. Now he was so keen he auditioned despite the fact he said, I have a pretty atrocious voice, but we had a friendly thing where it was me and him and a piano player and we tried to sing a song together, and to be honest, it didn't go well. I think it was Lean on Me, and when I hit the high note, Baz just turned to me and said, yes, D, because that's what he does. Yes, D, I know this just might not be a conversation we should continue.
But what you should continue with is the big picture. Stick around.
Welcome back to The Big Picture on this lovely Sunday evening. Fancy a bit of music? Well, a little early in the show, we were reviewing God's Not Dead 2. Here's a song from that film, The Newsboys' Guilty.
Breaking a rule, to say your name out loud in school. When your name's the only one that sets us free. When did it become incorrect to speak the truth about life and death? When your life gave us all eternity. Even if it gets me convicted, I'll be on my knees with my hands lifted. If serving you's against the law, man, if living out my faith. Convicted, I'll be on my knees with my hands lifted. If serving you's against the law, man, if living out my faith in you is banned, then I'll stand right before the jury, saying I believe is out of line. If I'm judged 'cause I'm gonna give my life to show. My faith in you is banned, then I'll stand right before the jury, saying I believe is out of line. If I'm judged 'cause I'm gonna give my life to show.
Newsboys Guilty, a Christian pop rock band founded in, of all places, Mooloolaba in Queensland.
Mooloolaba in Queensland.
There you go. Back in 1985, Hot Peter Furler and George Perdikas started off a band which has seen multiple changes of lineup. They've now released 17 studio albums, which is an epic thing in itself, six of which have been certified gold. And currently the band consists of, well, gee, a bunch of people. But amazingly, that collision, you know, in, that sometimes happens in Christian music. Michael Tate, the formerly of DC Talk, is now their lead singer. So,
and they, the Newsboys appear prominently in both God's Not Dead 1 and 2. Because interestingly enough, I'll try not to give the game away too much, the concerts of the Newsboys figure prominently at key moments in both film. That's all I'm going to say.
And one of the things I think is worth drawing out in Guilty is a section of the lyrics. If saying I believe is out of line, if I'm judged because I'm going to give my life to show the world the love that fills me, then I want to be guilty. It kind of threw me back on a phrase that used to get bandied around a lot when I was a younger Christian. If you were accused of being a Christian, would there be enough evidence to convict? And a song that reminds us of that idea is well worth considering, because as Christians, you know, it's not just about our profession, but about the way we demonstrate the fact that we believe.
We're on to our next now showing choice for this week, Mark. Australian films can be really hit and miss with Australian audiences. Maybe it's because, true to our tall poppy syndrome nature, we're most critical of our own stories. Maybe that's the reason. But a newfound gem of an Australian story will be opening at selected cinemas this week. And that's why it's our now showing choice, our second one for the show. A Month of Sundays stars Anthony LaPaglia and Julia Blake as a man. Well, Anthony LaPaglia is the man. As a man in the middle of a midlife crisis who stumbles into the company of a woman he mistakes as his mum, and that doesn't sound terribly unusual, till you realise that his mum's dead. Mark says A Month of Sundays has discovered... Mark has discovered that A Month of Sundays is a kitsch comedy that still manages really endearing moments and a strong message about the need to be moving on in life, even if we're not sure how to get to wherever it is we're going.
Yeah.
Hello, dear.
Something interesting happened today.
Well, sweetheart, it's your mother.
Mum?
Didn't your mum...
Yeah, late last year.
Pass away, yeah, I remember you saying.
It's just the wrong number. She sounded like she might be an interesting person.
It's for you, Frank.
Who is it?
It's Freud.
I'm Frank.
You must be. Come in, please. And what do you do, Frank?
I don't like to say that I work in real estate. Not because it's evil.
Frank, this is my son, Damien.
But it's just every time I say it, someone always says, oh.
What's this place worth, do you reckon?
Anthony LaPaglia stars as Frank, this middle-aged man who has good reason to feel remorse about his life. Career-wise, Frank is in something of a slump. He's a real estate agent in the midst of a property boom who doesn't seem to be able to sell a property. He also has a marriage that is on the rock. Justine Clarke actually plays Wendy's wife.
Justine Clarke from Play School?
Yeah. She's basically, their marriage has faltered and ended in divorce, but she still finds the need to come back to him to get life advice, which he's kind of really struggling to give. And his son, Frank Jr., is a teenager who is showing all the level of disdain that you basically find at that age. So, however, it's Frank's regrets over his mother and the relationship, this sort of unfinished relationship he had with her, that's really centered to the plot, because mum actually died, as you said in the introduction, you know, a few months earlier, and then a missed call that turns up on the phone one day has him talking to a woman he thinks is his mother. This unpacks a whole lot of feelings and actually creates this sort of emotional drive for the rest of the plot. It is, in fact, a really endearing Australian film. Funny, good to laugh at, but at the same time, really worth watching.
I'm almost amazed, Mark, that these words are coming out of your mouth, because you're not much of a fan, usually, of Australian films across the board, but you're giving this a thumbs up. Why?
Look, I think to begin with, this is exactly what Australian film should be. It concentrates so well on stories we know how to tell. It's set in great locations that we can offer, not just, you know, Ayers Rock or the Harbour Bridge or something like that. It's actually set in picturesque suburbs of Adelaide, okay? It shows a stage of life that's really interesting too.
Do you know which suburb it was set in Adelaide? I'm from Adelaide.
Yeah, I know, and I really wish I could tell you.
Oh, come on, mate.
A nice one.
Good, no, very specific. No, sorry, please continue.
Well, aren't they all nice? Anyway, okay.
I'm glad to hear a movie was set in Adelaide.
Look, so you've got this situation where you've got great chemistry too. You know, like, we actually allow some of our best actors to really shine. So LaPaglia and Blake's on-screen interaction is pitch perfect. It's kind of like, you know, mother and son meets Driving Miss Daisy. It's just, it's funny, but
that sounds
it's
great.
Really, I know, it's funny, it's really heartfelt. And I think also the other thing that's kind of interesting in it is that it has, like, veteran funny man John Clarke, who has the driest sense of humour in Australia today, as Frank's boss, Philip Lang, and he doesn't overwhelm the plot. You know, like, we're not just going back to him. I'd be tempted as a writer to be cutting back to him all the time for a good joke, but he's just really good. In fact, he builds it out.
But how does that actually happen? Because you are selling me on wanting to see this. It sounds really good, but it does still sound a bit like a one-joke plot, like, oh, you missed a call from your mum. Your mum's dead. What? But once you get past that, how is there something to the rest of this story?
Well, the whole film is very much about people getting stuck in a place and not being able to move on. I've heard some psychologists refer to this as sort of emotional arrestation. You know, the idea that...
What?
Yeah, the idea...
Arrestation as in arrested. Arrested. Like arrested development.
So kind of like the idea that some big event happens in your life.
Yes.
And you just don't move past it. And I think some people have, like, emotionally stayed.
So you're, like, held there, like you're arrested on the spot in
some
that place in your life.
Some people have never moved on from the point that they lost their job somewhere. Some people have never moved on from their teenagehood. I mean, a big event sort of freezes at particular points.
Yes.
And Frank is in this sort of situation. His mother has died, and it's been almost like the culmination of unresolved feeling about his past and can he actually move on? And to me, that is actually a really interesting idea, which gets past the one joke. And so now you've got the relationship between Frank and Sarah, and Sarah is really saved, is almost at the end of her life trying to help him think about seeing what is left in the rest of his.
Right. So what kind of thing is she helping him to see? Like, does Frank reach some sort of point of understanding? Is Sarah helping him to reach that point?
It's almost like the film says, you've got to be able to put the past down and move on without telling us how to do it or what you might be moving towards. So there's a very strong sense of the need to move on, but not much in the way of tools about, you know, how to do that. And right. And so that, for me, that's probably one. It's a classic redemption plot, if you like. Someone who's stuck. Could be crotchety Clint Eastwood in Gran Torino or Jeff Bridges in Crazy Heart. You know, the need to put the past down and move on. But we don't really learn in this one how he does it. So for me, I think A Month of Sundays does sort of like slip at that point. There are better things ahead, is what we've got to almost say. And that to me is a little bit of a problem, because as a Christian, the way we actually deal with the past is to resolve the past. That's why people can't leave the past behind, so to speak, because it's still tied to them with all sort of unresolved feelings. So if I were to add anything, it would have been a better idea of how Frank gets over things. But I've got to say, it is emotionally uplifting. I know we've actually got a great parents film coming up in this, but I would put up A Month of Sundays if you don't like our second choice.
Oh, all right then. Before we get to what your parents are watching this week, that was A Month of Sundays, and it has opened in selected cinemas. This opened last Thursday. And it stars Anthony LaPaglia and Plague School's own Justine Clarke and Julia Blake. It's rated PG for mild themes. There's those mild themes again. Just, they're mild. They're tepid. They're lukewarm. Mild themes and coarse language, including death, though.
Such a mild thing.
Death's now a mild theme. Yeah. Strange.
And I've got to say, if you actually want to match your opinion against mine or Ben's, well, check out our Facebook page. That's a great place to actually start the conversation with us. We'd love to hear from you guys there. Or actually just see more of our opinion over at thebigpicturewebsite.com.
Still to come on the show, Meryl Streep can't sing, and we'll explain why. And also, a young bloke tells us all about what it's like to serve older people day in and day out. Youngsters today. Welcome back to The Big Picture. Mark was just talking to us about this excellent new Australian film called A Month of Sundays. And he was telling us about there's a lot of interaction in the film between younger and older people and just how fantastic it is to witness that on screen. It got us thinking during the week about people that do that on a regular basis. So for our press record segment this week, I caught up with Richard Arthur, who used to be an assistant chaplain at a retirement village. He's a younger bloke and he got to connect with older people on a regular basis. So we asked Richard what that experience was like for him, what he got out of it. Richard Arthur, thanks for joining us on The Big Picture. Now, mate, you worked in aged care for a number of years. Tell us a little bit about where you worked and what kind of roles you had.
Sure. So I used to work for the Anglican retirement villages. I initially worked as a carer, so I was attending to people's needs, nursing needs, toileting, showering, all of that sort of thing. I then moved into what's called lifestyle, which are running activities, and then I moved into pastoral care.
What do you think older people got out of it by working with a younger bloke?
I think I'm quite an anomaly. I'm a single white male in an industry that has a lot of migrants, a lot of older females. One thing I noticed was you became sort of like another grandson to these people. So whether they had grandchildren or not, they would tell you how their life is going. They were very interested in your life. In fact, most of the time, I think I was answering their questions. They were just very curious to know what was going on with me. So on a weekly basis, yeah, it was like a catch up each time.
Sounds like a pretty awesome place to work. Okay, so what about the other way? You being younger and working with older people, and as you said right at the start of this, in many different capacities for them. How did you find it? What kind of things did you get out of it?
It brings a lot of perspective. I mean, aged care facilities put older people out of sight, out of mind. We don't see the suffering. We don't hear the suffering, any of that sort of thing. So I was confronted regularly with human suffering. What I got out of it was just building more empathy, more of a sympathetic persona.
Was it depressing?
At times, yeah, definitely. I mean, I was exposed to, you know, people who had limbs removed. There were people who, I've seen people die. I've discovered people dead, things like that. So it is an extremely confronting environment.
Mate, are there other benefits of working across generations? I can't think of too many situations in society where younger people work so directly with older people. What do you think are some benefits of younger and older working together and sharing more time together?
I think it builds an appreciation of how much people went through sort of for us to inherit Australia at this point. They definitely worked a lot harder. There are more hardships that I hear from people in these facilities. The working conditions were never as pleasant as we have. Obviously, you know, some of these people have been through a depression and World War II and the Korean War and the Vietnam War, all these sorts of different global catastrophes that we haven't really faced. And so, again, it's just more perspective. You also get an appreciation for music that you would otherwise never have been exposed to, like the likes of Vera Lynn and Doris Day.
You're a Christian and you got to work in chaplaincy pastoral care in the retirement villages. What was it like getting to share your faith with older people?
I found it very difficult at times. The generation in the aged care facilities we have at the moment are generally one that look at authority. So being an older person gives you great authority. And so being a younger guy going in there as a Christian and wanting to share with them the good news about Jesus could be quite hard. I mean, they've spent some of these people a lifetime doing, you know, building companies and being through all these hardships. And the last thing they need to hear is that there's something they haven't quite worked out, which is their relationship with God. Some people, as a result of their hardships, were very angry with God. So even by virtue of just saying, I'm the pastoral carer, they would already launch into why God didn't exist and why I was foolish to believe it. But over time, it's like most relationships, is you just keep going back, you keep showing love and grace, and eventually people are willing to listen to you.
Well, as we hinted earlier on in the show, we're actually not doing our classic What Your Kids Are Watching segment this week. Instead, we're doing What Your Parents Are Watching or something.
Oh, see what we did there?
I sort of feel like it's something every now and again. You get that. You think to yourself, your parents have suggested they might want to go after the pictures, and they even look at you and say, what would you like to, what should I go and watch?
And they say things like the pictures.
Yeah, the pictures. What? I didn't say the flicks. Okay, could have been worse. Anyway. Meryl Streep isn't just known for her full shed of Oscars. She also sings a bit on screen, you know, from Postcards from the Edge to Mamma Mia and Into the Woods to Ricky and the Flash. But she can't sing, okay, because we know that for sure now because she's the lead in Florence Foster Jenkins, a film about a woman who can't sing. So Streep stars as a real-life American socialite who wanted to be an opera star despite her obvious lack of singing talent. The comedy drama of her aspiring life brings some noise about the importance of honesty, even when it will crush the hearts of those we love.
Now, I must warn you, I work very hard. I study an hour every day. Sometimes two.
She's remarkable, isn't she?
She can't be a little flat.
Flat?
Just a tad.
If you can forgive Madame Florence her little eccentricities, you will find her to be a most generous person.
The lady is a lesson in courage, and that's why we love her.
Bravo, funny. And all the reviews are just terrific.
Yeah. Ours is a very happy world.
Mark, this is set in the 30s, 40s in New York, and Meryl Streep is doing a fine job, as you'd expect, as Florence Foster Jenkins, this patron of the arts in New York. She's established this club, the Verdi Club, about 25 years before the start of the movie and the events that we go on to see here. And she's married to Hugh Grant. Well, he's playing this character called St. Clair Bayfield. Hugh Grant puts in an excellent performance in this film. He's fantastic as this guy who's really quite devoted to Florence. And it's hard to tell early on whether he's just trying to be with, whether he's just with her for her money or whether he really, really loves her. But you get a better indication of that as you go along across the film. And most of the film is dedicated to Florence trying to realize her ambitions of being an opera singer. She is a woman who loves music. And as we're told constantly throughout the film, music matters and music makes a difference in life. And this is a lot of the film is set around wartime as well. So there's a lot of talk about the importance that music can have for uplifting the spirit. So that's what goes on in Florence Foster Jenkins. And also should point out one of the other co-stars in the film is Simon Helberg from The Big Bang Theory. I didn't really watch that TV show, but based on seeing him on screen in this movie, I will not watch The Big Bang Theory. I can explain why later.
Look, I've got to ask, This storyline does sound remarkably familiar.
There's
another film that's actually been released with the same
idea.
Yeah,
we mentioned this on the show last week. There's a French film called Marguerite, and it's based on exactly the same story. Florence Foster Jenkins was a real woman. Go and check her out online. There's recordings of her singing online. You can listen to those. I'm not exactly sure which one came first, but what Marguerite does is it's inspired by the story, and it just creates a new socialite in Paris.
So we're used to Americans ripping off European.
It's finally gone the other way. And this one's going to get much more attention, right? Because go back to the bit where it's got Meryl Streep and Hugh Grant above the title. Many more people are going to see this than Marguerite.
Look, are we laughing at or with Florence? That seems to be the key question.
That's a great question. And I've still left a little bit confused at the end of the film about which way we're meant to go. This is from director Stephen Frears. His last movie was The Program, which we spoke about on the show. Go to thebigpicturewebsite.com and check out our review of The Program. That was the film that was based on the life and times of Lance Armstrong. And that film felt like a witch hunt. That film felt like you are meant to hate Lance Armstrong. You were meant to go after this guy. Florence Foster Jenkins, on the other hand, as much as you see many scenes of a woman who's being mocked by those around her, not necessarily those in her inner sanctum, they're the bits that are harder to tell, such as the St. Clair character played by Hugh Grant. Is this man keeping up with her delusion because he wants money out of her, he's laughing behind her back, or does he love her so much and so devoted to her that he wants to kind of put her in cotton wool and protect her from discovering that her talent isn't anywhere near what she thinks it is? So whether we're meant to, as the audience, laugh with or at Florence, I'm not really sure. One of the downsides of this movie is that the tone is a little bit all over the place. It picks up as it goes along, but the first half hour or so, it's very hard to understand whether some lines are meant to be comedy or not. And the screening that I was in, people didn't laugh, I reckon, for the good first 25, 30 minutes. It picks up after that. But it's awkward knowing whether you're meant to laugh at the awkward moments or not.
Okay, well, so what does that mean, basically, that we should try and not mock people? Is that what you took away from the film?
No, yeah, I did, but I don't know if that's the actual message of the story. So that's true, and a lot of the hilarity can come from just how badly Meryl Streep sings and then the reactions of those around her. And so, yes, I think one of the messages you can take from it is you shouldn't mock people. There are some terribly awkward scenes, including one at Carnegie Hall, which is one of the biggest live music venues in New York City. Where Florence performs, and there's a crowd of like thousands of people, and they jeer her, they laugh at her in her face, and she's got to this point because people haven't been honest with her about her lack of talent, so effectively they set her up for a major fall. One of the reasons I didn't like this co-star Simon Helberg in the film, who plays the pianist who's accompanying her, called Cosme McMoon. His real name's they've got outlandish names in this.
In this entertainment
business.
Ben McEchen.
I know. Nowhere near as outlandish as Cosme McMoon. Come on. That sounds like they made that up. So Simon Helberg playing this character, often his reactions to Florence's terrible singing and then people around her not telling her the truth. He does this weird kind of twitchy, nervy, he's on the cusp of laughing or not laughing constantly. It becomes very distracting throughout the film. So I wasn't clear, still at the end of the film, whether we're not meant to be mocking people. What I took away more from this film, it's not necessarily hammered home, but it's definitely a big part of Florence Foster Jenkins, is telling people the truth, even if it's going to crush their dreams. Mm. We talked about Eddie the Eagle on the show last week. Go to thebigpicturewebsite.com, find the review. That's another story that talks about focused on someone who is so determined to follow their own dreams. Often people around them don't tell them the truth. Although Eddie the Eagle, he does cop the truth a lot and he hears it. Florence often has it sheltered from her. And effectively, she's not really living in reality.
What you're actually
point.
Doing is hurting that person.
Yeah, so a big question coming from the film, particularly around this character that Hugh Grant plays and plays very, very well, I thought, is he doing the right thing? Should you tell the blunt truth at particular times? And as Christians, we put big emphasis on honesty and the truth and telling people how it is and the reality of things. And if you sugarcoat it, it can go worse for them. Florence is basically a living example of that, but the film itself doesn't necessarily tell us which way to go on that. Mm. You walk away making that choice up for yourself.
Okay, well, look, Florence Foster Jenkins is performing on a screen near you from this Thursday, May 5th, stars Meryl Streep and Hugh Grant, and is rated PG for, there it is, mild themes and coarse language. We're having a running dialogue about mild themes.
Yeah, but it's good that we're talking about so many PG-rated films. That's excellent. There are so many kind of quote-unquote nicer movies out there, as PG would suggest.
They're mild.
Over at Insights, Mark, insights.uca.org.au, you can read a tandem review of Florence Foster Jenkins and Marguerite. So they're different names, different nationalities, but same source, same story, both on our screens at the moment. And Russ Matthews, a reviewer at insights.uca.org.au, has captured both in the one review. What does he make of them side by side? Find out.
Still to come, we've actually got a wonderful gem being dug up out of the vault for us, and also my top five musical films. It's going to be a hootenanny of a
la,
time.
La, 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 la.
It's going to be better than that. This week in our top five, we want to finish off on a musical note. Having had a fair dose of opera, we thought it'd be good to remind you of some of the other beautiful notes that Hollywood has sounded over the years with my top five musical films of all time. Now, for two reasons, I'm going to exclude right off the bat cartoon animations from my countdown.
Oh, well, the
first reason I'm going to do this is because it would probably mean I'd have to play Frozen's Let It Go again, and honestly, I paid attention to the title and I've let it go.
I thank you, and many other people thank you.
The second reason we're not going to do cartoon animations from my count in my countdown this week is that I would probably have to play The Lion King, and it makes me sad.
When did you mention that on the Big Picture a long time ago? Because you went on and on about how that song, that Hakuna Matata, affected you as a person right up until this day.
Yes, it bugs me so much that I can't actually listen to it.
I'm so sorry I've raised it again. Please continue.
But I'm certain you won't be disappointed with what I've chosen. So without further ado, Maestro.
Five.
I can't start a top five without just getting in as early as I possibly can from 1952's Singing in the Rain, the title track, sung by Gene Kelly.
I'm singing in the rain, just singing in the rain. What a glorious feel, and I'm happy again. I'm laughing at clouds so dark up above. The sun's in my heart, and I'm ready for love. Let the stormy clouds chase everyone.
Quite apart from a fantastic dance sequence that is involved in Singing in the Rain as a musical, there's just a bunch of tracks that are worth your attention. So Make 'em Laugh is like one of these wonderful sort of slapstick musicals that's sort of going on inside the film itself. And there's an interesting fact. Gene Kelly asked Donald O'Connor, who's one of the key dancers in there, to repeat a trick that he'd done as a much younger dancer. Now, it's almost cliche, this trick now, where the dancer runs up the wall and does a sort of a backflip. Okay, but this was done first time Singing in the Rain, right? Except that O'Connor was a four-pack-a-day smoking kind of guy by the time he'd come to do this trick, and he'd done it when he was much younger, but Gene Kelly says, can you do it again? But he's so dedicated, he does it again and again and again, so many times, in fact, that he actually spends a week in hospital after the shoot, only to return to find out that they'd actually destroyed all the takes by accident, and he had to do the whole thing all over again. That is Hollywood dedication. But nothing like the dedication that comes out in my fourth choice.
Four.
How could we talk about musicals, musicals of all time, without talking about 1965's The Sound of Music? And I know you're thinking at this point that I'm going to play something like I Am 15 Going on 17, actually 17, something like that.
Please stop singing, Mark.
I will.
Please
I
stop
will.
Singing.
There are so many Edelweiss, there's so many classics of The Sound of Music itself. The Hills Are Alive. But no, my favourite song is, of course, The Lonely Goatherd.
High on a hill was a lonely goatherd, lay, 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 ooh. Loud was the voice of the lonely goatherd, lay, lay, lay. Folks in a town that was quite remote, lay, 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 ooh. Lusty and clear from the goatherd's throat, lay, lay, lay.
You wanted to fade that down earlier than me. I could have spent the rest of the song just listening there. It's great fun. Anything that actually brings yodeling back into, you know, popular culture is
true,
fine by
bring
me.
Bring it back.
Interestingly, though, Sound of Music has never actually gone far from popular culture. Every year, Hollywood Bowl in Los Angeles, is one of those great venues, hosts an annual Sound of Music sing-along where the song lyrics are shown underneath the screen. Now, that in itself is not something terribly unusual. This is the actors who played the Von Trapp children and the original real Von Trapp children regularly turn up to sing along with the crowd.
Wow.
Wouldn't you just go for that? It's almost always a sold out event. It is consistently incredible.
I'm not that surprised. I'm sure the guys who played the Von Trapp kids, no one remembers those actors and I don't think they've ever worked again. So they just wait for that call every year. When can we get back on stage with the real Von Trapp kids and sing these songs that everybody likes?
Move us on to number three. Okay, now we're moving into the heavy hitters, as far as I'm concerned, the really cool musicals. For a start, 1978's Grease, okay? This is something I think that just featured in every talent quest that I ever watched as a child, you know?
I thought you were going to say that you ever competed in as a child. No, I was waiting for that story.
Brave. Never that brave, not at all. Okay, but for me, I think you can't go past You're the One That I Want, sung by John Travolta. Oh, and Olivia Newton-John. I think we've probably just caused car accidents, you know, because people are like just getting into the groove of that song and then we've cut them short.
Sorry,
and now
I shouldn't laugh. That's actually serious. So terrible. I'm really hoping we didn't do that. But that song does cause, it would cause people to stop in traffic.
It is fantastic. In fact, all drive irregularly as they're sort of bouncing from side to side of the car. Interestingly enough, it was filmed over the director Randall Kleiser actually filmed this scene, You're the One That I Want, over the background of an existing carnival. Like, there's a real carnival in town, and so he got them to be part of the film, and they filmed the dance sequence around that carnival scene. But then the next day, he realized that additional scenes were needed, and the carnival had left town. Okay, so go watch the film again. See if you can pick the scenes where they've actually just quickly fabricated some backgrounds that look like carnivals, and then cut that into the carnival. There's fun. Number two is just one of those films I've sat down and watched time in, time out. As a kid, then with my own kids, this is one of the easily accessible musical films of yesteryear. It is 1968's Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
Chitty bang bang, chitty chitty bang bang, chitty bang bang, chitty chitty bang bang. Oh, you pretty chitty bang bang, chitty chitty bang bang, we love you. And in chitty chitty bang bang, chitty chitty bang bang, what we'll do, near, far, in a motor car, oh, what a happy time we'll spend. Bang bang, chitty chitty bang bang, our fine four-fendered friend. Bang bang, chitty chitty bang bang, our fine four-fendered friend.
Chitty bang bang, chitty chitty bang bang, chitty bang bang, chitty chitty bang bang. What I can't believe is actually my co-host has never actually seen this film.
True story, never seen it.
You've got such a great time ahead of you. I mean, there's so many different fun things in it. Okay, you know, the posh, posh, travelling life, the travelling life for me. There's all sorts of great
sequences
and songs.
I asked you not to sing earlier.
Songs.
I'm going to repeat that.
I know. One of the best songs, okay, is this thing called Toot Sweet, okay? It's this where
you have me at Toot Sweet.
I know. It's where the creator of the sort of out-of-work inventor of the film, played by Dick Van Dyke,
of course he is.
Invents these lollies, you know, which you can play musical tunes on. And there's this massive scene involved in this factory where everybody starts dancing in the manufacturing of Toot Sweets, okay? It took 3 weeks to film, involved 38 dancers, 40 singers, 85 musicians, and 100 dogs. 100 dogs to set free on the set. It's incredible to watch. It's well worth seeing just for that scene.
One.
But I have actually come now to my ultimate musical. This makes me laugh. It has set many of my opinions on how we should see the world.
Wow, like life-defining movie.
I know, it's incredible. It is 1964's My Fair Lady. If you haven't seen My Fair Lady, there's so much ahead of you that is really worth seeing. It is probably the best Audrey Hepburn film, I think, that's ever been made. It's brilliant, and it has, as part of it, a wonderful song called Wouldn't It Be Lovely?
All I want is a room somewhere, far away from the cold night air, with one enormous chair.
Oh, wouldn't it be lovely? Lots of chocolate for me to eat, lots of coal, Mike, and lots of meat. Warm face, warm hands, warm feet. Oh, wouldn't it be lovely?
So much in the way of comedy and interaction between great actors in this film. It's well worth seeing for that reason alone. But there's a beautiful selection of film, a song all the way through. Now, here's one of the interesting things, though, that really almost crushed me when I found out about this. Because I think Audrey Hepburn is just one of those great talents of yesteryear. And she does not sing her own songs in this film.
No?
No, she's actually dubbed.
That is a bit disappointing.
I know, it was a bit, except that she's dubbed by some marvellous. Marnie Nixon did, you know. In fact, Marnie Nixon actually dubbed a number of great people in terms of her singing throughout sort of cinema history. But it actually reminded me, as I thought about it, of just what happens in the Christian life. Because, you see, here we are doing our performance, and sometimes we can't measure up. I mean, let's face it, we are just not the people we would like to be, even in our own heads. And Jesus comes along and dubs us. You know, and I know that sounds like
never heard it expressed like that, but I'm with you. So I'm with you on this.
It sounds like a bit of a reach, but the truth is that, you know, you've got the beautiful strains of Marnie Nixon coming in over the top, making Audrey Hepburn look and sound a thousand times better than she ever would be naturally. And me, I think about it, and I think I'm pretty happy that Jesus is dubbing my life, because if I get to the end with my notes that I've been singing, I'm not going to be in a happy place. To me, you can't go wrong with My Fair Lady.
Was a pretty lovely list that you just cranked out for us then. Thanks very much. Say, nice work.
I'm going to spend my entire weekend now going back and actually watching musicals. It's fun times.
All right. That was this show. Coming up on the next show next week, next Sunday from 8, Mark.
Oh, Captain America, Civil War. Oh, the humanity. What is the world coming to when superheroes can't agree?
I can't believe they can't agree. And what's worse, Mark, than Bad Neighbors? Bad Neighbors 2, the sequel. But is it bad, bad? Or is it bad, so bad it's good? Or is it so good it's bad? Or we'll find it next week.
Look, if you think that's confusing, try imagining infinity. Or just watch The Man Who Knew Infinity with us. See you next week.
La 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 la. I'll be Bebe Kekin.
Never do that again.
The Big Picture is a Bible Society Australia production, sharing the light of God's word into every corner of your world.